This Torah class is brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.
As Bechol Dor Vador, Chayiv Adam Liros Esasmo Ki Ilu Hu Yotzam Mitzrayim. You're supposed to relive Yitzias Mitzrayim, and in every generation, a person is supposed to feel like he personally went out of Mitzrayim. Okay. However, I've asked thousands of people all over the world this question. How many of you, at any Seder you've ever been at, when the Seder was over, felt like you were a slave in Egypt and set free that night? And nobody ever raised their hand. Nobody, including myself. One man said, I know what it's like to be in Egypt. I was in Auschwitz. I said, that's not the question. The question is, did you feel from a Seder? So what does that mean? That the mitzvah can't be fulfilled, right? Many times people come to the end of the Seder very frustrated. Another year went by, I don't feel like I was a slave in Egypt. My wife tells me that every year she feels like she was a slave in Egypt, but she doesn't ever feel she went out. That's a problem. In any case, so what does that mean? You can't have a mitzvah that nobody can fulfill. And even if great people can, but the common person has to be able to fulfill it. So I'm going to tell you three ways of fulfilling that. And at the end of the Seder, you don't have to feel frustrated. Because each of these ways is possible. Okay. First way is intellectually. We have a mitzvah to remember the exodus from Egypt every single day, twice a day. In addition, there are a host of mitzvahs that are for the sake of remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim. Comes out that about 1,000 times a year we remember the exodus from Egypt. Now, how feeble-minded did God think we were that if we wouldn't remember the exodus from Egypt 1,000 times a year, we'd forget it? Why this obsession with remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim? So one idea is the following. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in his Sefer HaKuzari, in the preface there, asked the following question. He says, every nation has their traditions. So we were born Jewish, so we have our Jewish traditions. We believe because there was a Yetzias Mitzrayim and a Kriyas Yamsuf and a Matan Torah. So that's the basis of our religion. How do we know that? Because our parents or somebody of their generation told us. How do they know? Because their parents or somebody from that previous generation told them. All the way back to the people who were there. But if we would have been born Christians, so we'd have a Christian tradition. They also have a tradition. How do they know? Because they heard it from people from the previous generation, all the way back to the people who were there. So what's their tradition any worse than ours? And if you'd be born a Muslim, we'd have a Muslim tradition. And they also have a tradition. How do they know? Because somebody told them who told them all the way back to the people who were there. Comes out that what we believe in is only an accident of birth. Have we been born something else? We believe something else. Is there any significant difference between our tradition and their traditions? Says the Kuzri, yes, there's a very significant difference. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And if the weakest link is the first link, it's a very, very weak chain. If you trace their tradition back to its source, the source is extremely weak. Take Christianity. What's the foundations of Christianity? Not the details and the miracles and the foundation. That a human being was born who claimed to be the Son of God. Okay, came to bring the world, redeem the world or whatever, and he died and was resurrected. Those are basic foundations of Christianity. Okay. How many people witnessed the fact that he was the Son of God? Nobody. He claimed to be the Son of God. Did anybody see God giving out cigars when he was born? No. So we don't know for sure he was the Son of God. And how many people witnessed his resurrection from the dead? So there, the New Testament tells us how much they believe people witnessed it. There was a small group of his closest disciples and a group of swooning women. That's how they describe it. Now, his disciples had a vested interest in saying he came back, otherwise they were out of a job. And the women, with all due respect to the credibility of women, but swooning women, you could see anything when you're swooning. So what kind of foundation is that to the foundations of Christianity? Very, very weak. How about Islam is even worse. The entire foundation of Islam was that Muhammad claimed to have a dream in a cave, that the angel Gabriel came to him, revealed to him the Quran, and told him to start a new religion. That's it. He could have had the dream, it could have been a nightmare, it could have been he had a stomachache, it could have been a million things. Nobody videoed the dream, nobody shared it with him. It's a word of one person. And Muhammad happened to have a very cogent philosophical argument that convinced many people to accept his religion, went something like this: accept my religion or I'll cut off your head. Many people found that very convincing. So what's it called? Those religions, God, the Rambam says God wanted these religions to spread. So did the Ramban say. There's a reason. That's not now to go through why. But that is the foundation of those two religions. Very weak beginning. If our religion had started the same way, Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam had come to the Jewish people who were settled in Tel Aviv and said to them, listen, you got to hear what happened to us. We were backpacking through Egypt. They captured us, made us slaves. We worked hard there until one day God brought 10 plagues on the Egyptians, got us out of there. And when we came out, the sea split for us and God gave us his Torah. Here it is, believe us. So our religion would be the same thing. It started as the word of a few people of what they witnessed or whatever. But that's not how it started. Moshe didn't come and say, I saw these things. He said, you saw them all. The entire nation witnessed the 10 plagues. They witnessed Yetzias Mitzrayim. They witnessed Kriyas Yamsuf. They witnessed the giving of the Torah and heard God speak. And since it's something that supposedly happened in front of an entire nation, so either it happened, and if it didn't happen, then how do we have a tradition that an entire nation saw these things? There's only few other possibilities. Either somebody convinced the entire people they saw things they didn't see, which is improbable, or they made it up, which is also improbable. I'm not going to go in now why those things, but there's a deep reason why these things were improbable, that an entire nation made up something and foisted it on their children. And a third possibility is that somebody made it up 1,000 years later. But also, why would anybody believe him, an entire nation believe him, Ezra made it up? And wouldn't they say, but if it really happened, how come we never heard of it before? If it didn't happen, we never could hear of it. So nobody heard of it before if it didn't happen. Another possibility is it happened, but it changed over 1,000 years. The story got exaggerated. But again, there should be 15 different versions then, and there never was. So it's very, very probable that something that supposedly happened in front of an entire nation couldn't be falsified, and the tradition is sound. So therefore, Yetzias Mitzrayim, remembering the exodus from Egypt, reminds us of the strength of the foundation of our emunah and makes it strong. So the more we remember it and the more we think into what it implies, makes our tradition and our belief much stronger, on a much stronger basis. So that is one idea of why it's important. And once a year, we go through the details, and the rest of the year, we access what we did on Pesach night. Now we know the details, we just have to mention it. But in order for that to really be strong as a tradition, there has to be an unbroken chain from the people who actually witnessed this till today. And therefore, it behooves every generation to pass over, excuse the pun, this tradition to the next generation. And that's what Pesach Seder is. The current generation creates a link for the coming generation, that they should be able then to pass it on to their children, so there's an unbroken chain. If any generation refuses to accept the responsibility, the chain's broken and the tradition is weakened. And therefore, it says that anyone who says, I'm not interested in this? What's it all of it to you? Is a Rasha for Pesach. He may not be a Rasha, a wicked person, because what's he doing at the Seder? Wicked people usually don't come to Seders. They have other places to go. But he's at the Seder. But vis-a-vis what Pesach is, becoming a link in the chain for the future, and linking the coming generation to the past generation, he's a Rasha. Right? Vis-a-vis that, he's vis-a-vis Pesach, he's a Rasha. And therefore, telling over the story isn't just telling a story. It says, L'matasaper bo'ozne bincho ben bincho, tell it to the ears of your children and grandchildren. So the Apiri on the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch asks, if every father has to tell his child, why does the grandfather have to get involved? Let his son tell his son. Why does the grandfather have to tell his grandchild for it? The father will tell the grandchild. He says, and I have a different question. Why does it say you'll tell it to the ears of your children? The Torah doesn't waste a word, not even a letter. If he didn't tell him to tell us his ears, what do we do? Tell it to his big toe? Of course you tell it to his ears. Why does the Torah have to mention that graphically? Tell it to the ears of your children. So he says, on his question, why the grandfather? He says the grandfather doesn't have to tell his grandson anything. But he has to tell his son in such a way that it will get to the grandson, meaning that the son will be a link in that chain. If I tell him a story and he's not capable of giving it over, or I tell him a story and he's not interested in giving it over, I haven't fulfilled the mitzvah. That's why the Torah speaks about four different kinds of sons. Because you have to make the story fit that child's personality and his intellect. If you tell a story to a chacham that's fit for a tam, you'll bore him to death. If you tell a story to a tam that's fit for a chacham, it'll be over his head. You have to tailor-make the story. That's why it says ba'ozne. It has to go into his ears. It can't just be a generic story, right? Because you're not telling stories. You're creating a link in the chain of tradition. And therefore, you have to tailor-make it to that child. So therefore, it says, in every generation, a person has to see himself, consider himself as if he went out of Egypt. It doesn't mean that you have to feel like you're a slave in Egypt and set free. It means that that idea of Yetzias Mitzrayim is so real to you that you could say that I actually witnessed it. I know it's true as if I was there. How? Because it's an unbroken chain to something that happened to an entire nation. So by going over the whole story, it becomes so real as if you could say I was there and witnessed it, because the evidence is so strong that I can feel like I was actually there. That means you don't have to experience slavery and being set free. You have to intellectually be able to identify with it as if you could say, I know it's 100% true. It's as if I saw it. That's the first way, intellectually. Second way is emotionally, neshama-wise, not emotionally, neshama-wise. And that's the following. The Shurei Das tells the Rosh Yeshiva, ask the following question. He asks it in a very refined way. I'm going to ask it in an unrefined way to make the question stronger. If somebody had asked me to design a Seder whose purpose is to make you feel like you were a slave in Egypt and set free that night, then I would have designed the following Seder. If that's the purpose, I would say everybody has to invite 20 people to their Seder. And when they come, you divide them into two groups, Group A and Group B. Group A, you give whips and clubs. And Group B, you give building materials. You take them into your backyard, and you tell Group A to beat Group B while they build pyramids in your backyard. That goes on for a quarter of the night. At a quarter of the night, you blow your whistle. You don't have to be part of Group A or B because you're the host. You just get to blow your whistle. At a quarter of the night, you blow your whistle and you say, switch. Now Group B will beat Group A as they build pyramids. At midnight, you blow your whistle again and you say, you're all free. No more building, no more beating, go home, enjoy your yontif. I guarantee you, the people at my Seder will feel more like they were slaves in Egypt and set free that night, okay? They may never come to my Seder again, but they'll believe that. Right, they'll feel that a lot more than God's idea of a Seder. What's God's idea of a Seder? We want to now experience 210 years of bitterness, of slavery, and oppression. Let's eat some lettuce. What in the world does that bring across, right? 210 years of bitterness by eating lettuce? So what was God thinking when he designed the Seder his way, not my way? The Shurei Das asked the question a little more refined. He says, what could we do to really make people feel? We'd have a play. He says, the Goyim on Easter have a passion play. They all get up at sunrise, and they go to the Orange Bowl, and they have a play depicting the crucifixion of Yashka. Here's Mary, here's Pontius Pilate, here's Yashka, and they watch the play, and it really makes an impression. They go home feeling like you witnessed this, like it really happened. So why don't we have the same thing? Why don't we have a play? There's Moshe, Aaron, right? We can even, today, even better. They have a video with all the special effects. They have Steven Spielberg, right? I remember years and years ago when I was about 10 years old, the movie The Ten Commandments came out from Cecil B. DeMille. And I was in an afternoon Hebrew school at the time, and the Hebrew school took us to see a pre-theater presentation of this movie. Before it hit the movie theaters, they had a special viewing in a theater for Hebrew school kids. So I remember going and watching it. It was very impressive. And even they had special effects then that made it look like the sea split. You could see Mamash there. And I remember leaving that theater and saying as a 10-year-old that if Cecil B. DeMille could split the Red Sea, then God could too. And it really strengthened my emunah in Kriyas Yamsuf. So today we could have Mamash three dimension. You actually feel like you're there. You can even feel the spray of the water or whatever. Right? The what they could do today with special effects is unbelievable. So let's have a video. And we'll all really feel like we're part of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Wouldn't that be better than eating lettuce? So why? Why is God Seder his way and not my way or the Shurei Das's way? So what the Shurei Das says is the following. I'll give you a preface to what he says. An example. In the 1950s, they had drive-in movies. And they discovered something very interesting at those movies. They didn't make their money on the admission because you could just, you know, stuff 20 people in a car and pay one admission. What did they make their money on? They had a concession. Popcorn, soda, candy, which they sold at outrageous prices. You couldn't bring food into the theater, into the drive-in. And so you were stuck, and you got hungry, and you had to pay the money to buy it from there. But they wanted you to buy food and to be hungry. So they used to have, in the before the intermission, a whole thing about drinking Coke and eating popcorn or whatever. Then they discovered there's a much more potent way of advertising called subliminal advertising, where they splice in a nice ice-cold Coke or popcorn into the movie. And it goes by so fast, it's just one or two frames, so you don't register it consciously, but it like goes directly into your subconscious. And it becomes almost like a hypnotic suggestion. It's against the law to advertise like that in America. And they found that then people watching the movie, they had no idea that they were also watching at some point this hypnotic suggestion of drinking Coke. And then when the intermission came, they had this like urge to drink Coke and eat popcorn. Says the Shurei Das, similarly, something that affects your external physical senses makes an impression, lasts for a while, and wears off. But something that goes directly into your neshama, right, lasts much longer. And therefore the mitzvahs, and even the mitzvahs of the Seder, are extremely subtle. And therefore they bypass your external and go directly into your neshama and make much more of an impression. That's what he says. I want to couple what he says with what Michtav Meliyahu says, and together they're very, very make a very, very interesting case of what the Seder's all about. The Michtav Meliyahu, famous Michtav Meliyahu, but I want to give you a way of understanding it with the way I think is really meant. He says you can't look at time as a line, that you keep going into time. It's a circle. Really, it's a spiral. The way I understand it is the following. And we go through time around the circle. There are stations of time that we pass constantly. Okay, the way I like to explain is the following. Imagine 365 elevator shafts in a circle. The elevator shafts are unusual because the elevator doesn't only go up and down, but it goes around too. Okay? And those 365 elevator shafts are days of the year. The first elevator shaft is a time zone called the first day of Tishrei. The second one is the second day of Tishrei, and so on. The elevator started at ground level on the first day of Tishrei. That's the day that man was created. In that elevator shaft, on the ground level, is the creation of man. And then, next day was the second day of Tishrei, so the elevator, Adam HaRishon, went through time to the second day of Tishrei, to that second elevator shaft. Nothing important happened that day. Next day, the third elevator shaft, till he came around till the 29th day of Elul, the 365th elevator shaft. The next day, he went back to the first day of Tishrei, but not on the ground level. He went up one floor, and now on floor two was, what's it called, the same elevator shaft, just one floor above what the year before had been his creation. The memory of the creation of man permeates that entire shaft, from bottom to top. It's there, the memory. Okay, it's an entity. And every year you pass through that memory. That's called Rosh Hashanah. This past year we passed through the 5,779th level of that elevator shaft, where on the ground level was the creation of man. And the memory permeates the whole thing. So we passed through that memory on the first day of Tishrei. In a few weeks, we're going to pass through the station called the 15th day of Nisan. On the 2,448th level of that elevator shaft was Yetzias Mitzrayim. The memory of that is in that elevator shaft. And every year we pass through that memory. Now, the only thing is, you can pass through the memory, but how do you integrate it? So I'd like to give another marshal. You have a master computer which has a database in its memory bank everything you'd ever want to know about leopards. Okay? All the information about leopards or whatever is in that database. Now, you want to transfer that database into your personal computer. How do you do that? So you surely don't shake the monitor and let the memory fall out. Doesn't work. What do you have to do? You have to get a cable and connect the cable to the guts of this computer where the electric magnetic memory is and let it flow through the wires into the guts of the other computer and be collected in the memory bank of this computer. That's how you transfer the memory. The cable doesn't have to have spots like a leopard. It doesn't have to look like a leopard. But it has to be able to connect in to the guts of this computer and this one. So it has to have a certain amount of pins in a certain configuration and a certain size. If it's not the right configuration or the right size or the right number of pins, it won't work. It won't make the connection. Like the Shurei Das says, things that connect into your soul are very subtle. So God knew that when we pass on the 15th night of Nisan through the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim, like the Michtam Eliyahu says, we want that memory to transfer into our soul. So you have to make a connection. So you need a cable. Now again, the cable is a very subtle thing. It doesn't look like the memory. But God knows what creates that cable, what will connect into our neshama, and what will connect into the memory. And that's called Pesach Matzen Mor. That's the cable. So by fulfilling those mitzvahs properly, you create the connection between the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which you're passing through, and your neshama, and your neshama is recharged with that memory. So if you can end the Seder and say, Chasal Sidr Pesach, I fulfilled this mitzvah the way it's supposed to be done, then your neshama is charged up with the memory, and when it says, Bechol Dor Vador Chayiv Adam Liros is Atzmo, it means your essence. You don't have to feel it consciously. But if you fulfill the mitzvahs properly, you've created a transfer of the memory you're going through to your neshama. It's like charging a car battery. When you charge the car battery, you don't see any change in the battery. I mean, if you see the battery begin to glow and get bigger, run. It's not supposed to do that. Right? Looks the same, but it's charged. So too, if you fulfill these mitzvahs properly, then the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim has charged up your neshama, and everything you do now for the whole year comes from a charged neshama. You may not feel it consciously at all. There may be big people who can feel it consciously, but that's not the idea. The idea is your neshama now experiences the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The collective memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim now is charging up your neshama, and everything you do in the year comes off of that. It's like now the car can run because the battery's been charged. And it lasts a year. Next year you have to charge it up again. And that answers a question which usually comes up at almost everybody's Seder. Right? There's all different kinds of people at people's Seder. And usually when they come to Motzi Matzah, so the Yeshiva Bachrim, the girls from seminary, take out these plastic cards that have all the colored thing of how much matzah, and they start measuring it or whatever. And there's always somebody at the Seder, usually somebody named Aunt Matilda, who says,
really think that God cares how much?
Exactly. What are you doing? What difference does it make? This much, that? Do you really think God cares how much matzah? Just eat the matzah. We never did this when we were kids or whatever. So you say to Aunt Matilda the following, okay? Let's say we wanted to transfer the memory from one computer to another, and you're told you need a cable, okay? So would Aunt Matilda say, just get some wires, doesn't make a difference, how many pins, what configuration, how big they are, just plug it in, it'll work. It won't. If it's not the exact amount of pins and the exact configuration, the exact size, it won't make the connection. Same thing. We want to now do something that will connect us into the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim. God knows, right, that is matzah, mor, pesach, okay? How much matzah? There's a certain number of wires. There's a certain configuration, how you have to eat it, reclining. There's a certain kind of matzah, right? If you have what's it called, wires that are made out of something different than metal, wooden wires not going to work. So you have to have the right matzah, in the right amount, in the right configuration, and if you do it properly, it'll make the transfer. If you don't do it properly, it won't. Why is there any difference between transferring a memory from one computer to another than transferring the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim to your neshama? You have to have a right kind of cable. And this is the right guy. Finished. That's a second way.
I understand, though, the question, because matzah is something tangible, and the neshama is not.
I know, but that's even more real. You know, the tangible things in this world are temporary, but the intangible things are eternal. So if by tangible things you need it to be a certain way, surely in the real, real things you need it a certain way. But most people think that what's real is what you can see and feel. And spiritual things, that's not real. That's just, you know, an idea. So what difference does it make? But that's the real reality. So the second way of fulfilling it is on a neshama level. In every generation, a person has to consider atzmo, his essence, as if he went out of Mitzrayim. How do you do that? By fulfilling the mitzvahs properly. If at the end of the Seder you can say that you did it properly, then you know that you experienced Yetzias Mitzrayim on a neshama level. And the last way is on a personal, emotional level. How so? It says that when they translated the Torah into Greek, so they made some changes, stylish changes, because they were afraid that Talmi HaMelech would misunderstand. One of the changes is in this week's Sedra, that says that one of the non-kosher animals is an arneves, like a rabbit. But the wife of Talmi's name was Arneves. So they were afraid if they put Arneves and they translated it to the Greek, that she would think they're making fun of her, calling her a non-kosher animal. So instead of putting the word Arneves, they made a description thing, the long-legged, hopping creature. Didn't change the Torah, they just didn't put that word in. Okay. Another change they made is in the following sentence. It says, Moshe b'nei Yisro b'Mitzrayim, Shloshim shon v'arba me'er shana. The sojourn of the Jewish people in Egypt was 430 years. Now that can't be. We were not in Egypt 430 years. We know that Levi went into Mitzrayim. We know that Moshe, his great-grandchild, came out. We know exactly how long Levi lived, how long Kehash lived, how long Amram lived. Moshe was 80 when they went out. If you add all their years, one to end to the other, which they didn't live like that. They lived concurrently, not consecutively. It still doesn't come out to 430 years. So they said the sojourn of the Jewish people in Mitzrayim and other lands was 430 years. But we have the original Hebrew. It doesn't say other lands. What do we do with that sentence? So I always like to say, the answer, I think, is the following. The beginning of the sentence says, Moshe b'nei Yisro b'Mitzrayim, the sojourn of the Jewish people in Mitzrayim. The end of the sentence says, at the end of 430 years, Yatsu me'eretz Mitzrayim. They left the land of Egypt. There's a difference between the land of Egypt and Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim's a state of being. You can be a Mitzrayim anywhere in the world. Mitzrayim means you're in a state that is narrow, that is, what's it called, constricted, constrained. You can't express your essence. That's Mitzrayim. I call God out of my narrowness, and he answers me broad. He broadens my horizons. From the time that God decreed on Avraham Avinu that his children would be slaves and strangers or whatever, they already were in the status of Mitzrayim. They weren't in the land of Egypt, which was the place where that status was strongest in the world until the last 210 years. When they left the land of Egypt, but they were in the status of Egypt for 430 years. That's the difference. What is the status of Mitzrayim? Where a person's narrow and he can't express what he really wants to do. Every Jew, deep down, wants to do God's will. So what prevents him? The Gemara says, the Yetzer Hara, and outside influences sometimes prevent us from keeping God's will. The place in the world where those two things were strongest in the time when we were slaves in Egypt was Mitzrayim. They had the iron hand preventing us from being what we're supposed to be. And the Yetzer Hara was the most decadent place in the world, was Egypt. So the Yetzer Hara and Shibud Malchios made us very narrow, very constricted and constrained. So that is what's it called? That's Mitzrayim. It says that there's another Bechol Dor Vador, except in every generation a person has to consider himself as if he left Mitzrayim. In every generation, they want to destroy us, which means every generation and every person has their personal Shibud Mitzrayim. It didn't end. It was the beginning of a process. But every generation, every person has his Shibud Mitzrayim, where he's narrow, where he can't do what he really deep down knows that he should be doing. He wants to do God's will, but his Yetzer Hara prevents him, and outside forces prevent him. So everybody has their personal Mitzrayim. And on Pesach night, you're given the tools, if you want to make use of them, to be able to break those shackles and to work the whole year on freeing yourself with what you got on Pesach night. And therefore, when it says, Bechol dor vador chayiv adam liros es atzmo ke'ilu hu yotzem Mitzrayim, it doesn't say me'eretz Mitzrayim. You don't have to imagine like you were in the land of Egypt. But you have to picture your own personal narrowness, constriction, constraint, because of Yetzer Hara, because of outside influences, and imagine that Pesach night you're given the ability to break free from that and to reach your potential and become broaden your horizons. So it's a very emotional, personal thing. That's a third way of fulfilling it. It's interesting, just to end with this. If Eretz Mitzrayim, the land of Egypt, was the place where that status of narrowness was the strongest, at least at that time, and we're not allowed to go back to Egypt to live there because it still hovers there, that status, then there must be a place in the world which is the opposite, which is wide, not narrow, where you can really achieve your potential. Which land in the world is called wide? Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Tov Rechova. Did it ever bother you that Eretz Yisrael is not a wide land? I mean, it's not wider than Rhode Island. So what kind of wide land is this? Right? It's a chutzpah to call it a wide land. I remember when I was here as a tourist, the first and last time, 1981, 2 years before we came here. So we were on the Kvisha Mahir, the Yerushalayim-Tel Aviv highway. At that time, there were two lanes going each way. That was it. That was the super highway in Israel. The cab driver, I remember, we were in a cab. We were sitting in the back seat. And the cab driver was looking at us and talking to us the whole time, going about 150 miles an hour. And I was like, you know, wondering, do they have automatic pilots here on the cabs? How's this guy looking at us and driving without even looking where he's going? He says to us, "You're Americans, aren't you?" I said, very perceptive, since we're talking American English. He said, "Tell me the truth. In America, they have roads as wide as this?" I couldn't resist. I said, "Yes, we do. We call them one-way streets." That was the last he talked to me. But what kind of chutzpah the Torah calls Eretz Yisrael a wide land? What kind of wide land? But just like Mitzrayim isn't a narrow land, but it's a place where you're narrow. Eretz Yisrael is not necessarily a wide land physically. It's a place where you can be wide. That's the idea. That's Eretz Rechava. So there's three ways of fulfilling this feeling like you left Mitzrayim. One is intellectually, by identifying with what happened and feeling as if you witnessed it, because there's an unbroken chain of tradition to something that happened in front of an entire nation. Second way is on a neshama level. If you make the connection, your neshama is charged up with that memory that you passed through. And the third way is an emotional level, that everybody has their personal Mitzrayim and have to feel that night that they have the ability to break free from the shackles of their own personal Mitzrayim. Okay, have a chakosh of a sameach.
You've just experienced another Torah class brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.